Well, on our Wednesday nights, we have been working primarily through the Old Testament, and we have gone verse by verse, concept by concept, through the book of Isaiah and through Jeremiah and through his Lamentations. We went through Ezekiel and we went through Daniel, and as a consequence, we have now covered all of what are known as the major prophets. So tonight we're going to be looking at one of the minor prophets, and before this series is done, we're going to look at a good handful of the minor prophets. There are 12 minor prophets. There's Hosea and Joel and Amos and Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and then finally Malachi. Tonight we're going to be looking at some Zechariah and also looking at a little bit of Haggai in order to get context to understand the book of Zechariah. You've heard me before use the word Tanakh. The Tanakh is the Hebrew word for what we know as the Old Testament. That is their scripture. Tanakh means the Torah, the Nevi'im, the Ketuvim, in other words, the law and the prophets and the writings. And in the Tanakh, the 12 minor prophets are all kind of gathered as one book that they referred to as the 12. When we talk about Zechariah, there are actually 30 different people, some might argue 31, who are named Zechariah in the Old Testament. It's a very, very popular name, which you can understand because it means Yah remembers, or the Lord has remembered, or God remembers in Hebrew. Tonight, we're talking about this particular priestly prophet, Zechariah, and we're going to talk a little bit about where he came from and how it is that he began his prophetic career. We don't know a lot about him personally, except that we know that he was born in the Babylonian captivity. Now, the last major prophet that we worked our way through just a couple months ago was the book of Jeremiah. So we'll be drawing on some of the information that you learned in the Jeremiah teaching. The important thing to remember from Jeremiah at the moment is that he predicted that the Babylonian captivity was going to be 70 years. It's the same thing that Daniel saw, that Babylon was going to rise up and rule, and he was taken in the first wave of deportees into Babylon. So Daniel was born in Jerusalem or born in Judah and then transported into Babylon. Zechariah was born in Babylon during that 70 years and then made his way back to Jerusalem. What we know is that he was of the line of a priest, so that he is also a priest and a prophet. He was a contemporary with Zerubbabel. Now, we've talked about Zerubbabel before. After Babylon fell to the Medo-Persians, the first of their great kings, Cyrus, is the one predicted by Isaiah 150 years in advance. He is the one who formed the decree that allowed the Judahites to go back to Jerusalem, rebuild their temple, rebuild their walls. And that work began, and it went for about a year, but they underwent so many problems. They were being attacked by the surrounding enemies there in Jerusalem. They were going through periods of hunger. So there was so much difficulty that the work essentially stopped. And that was during the time of Nehemiah. Following Nehemiah, then, you get Ezra coming in. And during the time of Ezra, you get Haggai and Zechariah encouraging the people to start that work again, to rebuild the temple. And according to Ezra, which we'll look at in just a moment, Zechariah and Haggai were successful in re-inspiring the people to do the work. This is during the period where you read about them working with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. So they would have to build and fight and build and fight just in order to survive as they were rebuilding Jerusalem. But that is perfectly in keeping with what Jeremiah predicted, that they were going to go into Babylon for 70 years, but then they were going to come back. They were going to be renewed in the area of Jerusalem again, in Judah again, and they were going to rebuild their city, rebuild the walls, rebuild the temple again. And that's exactly what we're reading about here in Zechariah, the fulfillment of those things that Jeremiah talked about. According to Nehemiah 12:4, Zechariah's grandfather was a fellow named Iddo, and he returned with Zerubbabel, who I mentioned a moment ago. Of course, when Cyrus let them go back to rebuild Jerusalem, he wasn't going to let them have a king again. The Davidic kingly line effectively ended when the last king in that succession was taken into Babylon, blinded, and then killed. And so they decided to put a governor in place, and that was this fellow Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel and Nehemiah and a group of people were initially allowed to go back to Jerusalem to begin the rebuilding work, and that's when the work floundered and wasn't completed. And that takes us to the time of Zechariah inspiring them to go again. So according to Nehemiah 12:4, Zechariah's grandfather was a fellow named Iddo, and he returned with Zerubbabel in that first wave of people who came from Babylon into Jerusalem to start the rebuilding. Nehemiah 12:16 then lists Zechariah as the head of the priestly family of Iddo. His ministry was among those who returned from the exile, and then their descendants were resettled in the land of Judah. So the book of Zechariah then is set after the return of the exiles from Babylon back to Jerusalem, and we're told in the book of Ezra, Ezra 5, 1 and 2, that Zechariah and Haggai together challenged and motivated the people to rebuild the temple and to look for the fulfillment of the promises of God that came through Jeremiah the prophet. You getting all the connections? Have I lost anybody yet? Okay, good. Because the astounding faithfulness and grace of God is on display by the very fact that they are back in Jerusalem and rebuilding. I mentioned Ezra 5 a minute ago. I'm going to read Ezra 5, 1 and 2 to you. Ezra writes, "When the prophets, Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, who was over them, then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And the prophets of God were with them, supporting them." We're also going to come across this name, this Joshua or Jeshua. He becomes the high priest there in rebuilt Jerusalem, overseeing both the work of the temple and finally the sacrifices of the temple. So get used to his name. It's going to come up again. The book of Ezra names Zechariah, by the way, as you just saw, as the son of Iddo. But when you read the first verse of the book of Zechariah, it reads like this. It says, "In the eighth month of the second year of Darius," who's Darius? Darius is a Medo-Persian king. And there was a series of allowances, decrees that were made to finally allow the Israelites to go back and begin the rebuilding process. There was the initial decree from Cyrus, and then it was reestablished through Darius. But it ultimately didn't come to its fruition until Artaxerxes, say that name with me, Artaxerxes actually then was successful in bringing about a decree that brought the children of Israel back to the land of Jerusalem. So get used to these names. We're going to be hearing them a lot in the coming weeks. So as I was saying, the book of Ezra names Zechariah as the son of Iddo, But Zechariah chapter 1, verse 1 says, in the eighth month of the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to Zechariah the prophet, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, saying, the Lord was very angry with your fathers. So even though Ezra calls him the son of Iddo, that word son there just simply means a descendant. Iddo was his grandfather, and then his father was Berechiah. So don't get the idea that there's a conflict between the two accounts. The prophecies in the book of Zechariah cover about a two-year time span, but it's also pretty obvious that Zechariah continued to be there. His ministry continued among the people until that temple was rebuilt, even though he wasn't prophesying after what we read in the book. As a consequence, Ezra 5:1 records for us, and the prophets, Haggai the prophet and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. And then Ezra 6:14 says, and the elders of the Jews were building and succeeding through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. So they built and they completed it according to the decree of the God of Israel. Okay, that was the first prophecy that it was going to happen. They were going to return. They were going to rebuild. That was through Jeremiah, but also through the decree of Cyrus. Cyrus is the king that was predicted 150 years in advance in the book of Isaiah, saying that he was the king that was going to allow the Judahites to come back and begin this work. But it was the decree of Cyrus, and then Darius, and then finally Artaxerxes, the king of Persia. So even Ezra records that it took a series of decrees to finally get Jerusalem rebuilt and get the temple rebuilt. Have I lost anybody yet? Okay, good. The Old Testament also doesn't give us any indication about how Zechariah died. However, in Matthew 23:34-36, Jesus actually mentions Zechariah in his condemnation of those first century Jewish leaders. What he says is this. He says, I am sending you prophets and sages and teachers, and some of them you will kill and crucify. Others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town. And so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel. You know that Cain slew Abel, so that reaches all the way back to the book of Genesis. From the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. And truly I tell you, all of this will come on this Genea, this generation. So then if that's a reference, which it seems to be, to this very same Zechariah, then we actually do know how he died. He was actually murdered in the temple courtyard. The irony of that is that he was the prophet who inspired the people to keep the building of the temple going, and it was by his preaching, according to Ezra, that the temple was completed, and then the people killed him in the temple that he was busy establishing. Tremendous irony there. But also, the two people that Jesus mentions in Matthew 23, as long as I brought it up, Abel and Zechariah, are then the first martyr that you find in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis. And then chronologically, that is the last martyr that you find, Zechariah, through that whole Old Testament period. So he was really saying all the righteous blood of all the people you killed, all the prophets that I sent you, all the wise people, all the teachers, you're guilty of all that blood. And then he named the first person, the first martyr in the book of Genesis, killed by his own brother, and brought it up to the last one, who was Zechariah, killed in the temple. So at some time after Zerubbabel's temple was actually finished, then apparently Zechariah was actually in the temple and the people killed him, according to Jesus. And as you know, when it comes to Hebrew history and all things biblical, I am convinced that Jesus is the subject matter expert. And if he tells us that's how Zechariah died, then that's pretty good authority. I'm going to have to go with that. Zechariah's prophetic career is said in the very first verse to begin in the second year of Darius the Great. So that puts it right around 520 BC. So we're talking about 500 years roughly before Jesus came to the planet. That's when Zechariah was prophesying. The book of Zechariah is really, really interesting because he himself appears in the first 8 chapters. He is a major player in those chapters. But then in chapters 9 to 14, he's not really in it. He's just recording it. So the book begins with Zechariah calling the Jews as they are coming from Babylon and then coming back to Jerusalem, having begun the work and then failed at the work. He's calling them to return to Yahweh their God, and that's really the first 6 verses of the first chapter. But then as soon as he gets done with that call, he instantly launches into his first vision. And it's a thick and heavy symbolic vision. He doesn't wait around. There's no tapping your toes in the book of Zechariah. You get 6 verses, and then boom, you're into prophetic language. Now, when we were going through the book of Revelation, I told you that the way I was going to approach the book of Revelation is with a couple of primary assumptions. The first primary assumption was that nobody knows more about what John saw than John does. And so if John said, "This is what I saw," we have to just start. The prima facie idea is, okay, well, then that's what he saw. How we interpret it, how we understand it, is then dependent on how those same symbols show up other places in the Bible. Often the symbols that are recorded in the book of Revelation showed up earlier in the Old Testament, and that would help us to interpret it, because oftentimes those interpretations were given to us in the Old Testament. I'm going to approach the book of Zechariah the exact same way. My assumption is that what Zechariah says he saw is exactly what he saw. We're not going to mess with those details. We're going to look at it at face value and say, okay, now that's what he saw. Even if we don't completely comprehend the meaning, we're going to do our best to draw the meaning from elsewhere in the scripture and try to make a contextual argument for what we believe it means. And of course, I'll be looking at as many trusted commentaries as I can to try to get as close to the meaning as I possibly can. But the book of Zechariah is going to require a certain amount of interpretation in order to understand it. I'm not going to allegorize anything in Zechariah, because you know that I have argued for years that if we treat the Bible allegorically, then meaning changes according to the allegorist. Whoever's doing the allegorizing is going to give you their interpretation of what it means, and that meaning changes according to who it is that's doing the allegorizing. That's a terrible way to study the Bible, and it only leads to confusion. We're going to take the book of Zechariah at face value. We're going to read what it actually says, and then we will work through meaning very carefully. Okay, so since I have gone through that amount of trouble to introduce the book of Zechariah to you, let's begin in the book of Haggai, shall we? The book of Haggai is right before the book of Zechariah. It is the book immediately before it. The book of Haggai is two very short chapters, but the first chapter gives us context for the book of Zechariah because, as you may recall from 20 minutes ago, Haggai and Zechariah were contemporaries, and Ezra credited the two of them and their preaching for being the reason that the work continued and was successful. Haggai and Zechariah have two very different approaches to inspiring the people to get back to work. Haggai just comes in swinging and just reminds the people that this is the work that God has for them. Zechariah is more visionary, obviously, but he's also more encouraging. The end of the book of Zechariah contains some of the most messianic passages that you're going to find anywhere in the Old Testament. Language that we refer to frequently about Christ returning, his foot touching the Mount of Olives and how it splits and how Israel is going to look on him whom they have pierced. All of that very encouraging forward-looking language all comes from Zechariah. Do you know the difference between major and minor prophet?
The size of what they wrote.
The size of what they wrote. The major prophets and the minor prophets are divided simply by the length of their books. The book of Haggai, chapter 1, verse 1. In the second year of Darius the king, if that sounds familiar, that's the same way that the book of Zechariah begins. However, Haggai is a little bit earlier than Zechariah. On the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came by the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, same people who were named at the beginning of the book of Zechariah. Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, who was the high priest, saying, "Thus says Yahweh of hosts, Yahweh of armies." This is God's way of saying, "I am the sovereign God. I am in control of the hosts of heaven and all the peoples of the earth. Thus says that God, the Lord of hosts." He said, "This people says, the time has not come, even the time for the house of the Lord to be rebuilt." Because they came back and they tried. They tried to start rebuilding, but during the 70 years that they were in Babylon, the people from the surrounding Gentile nations began occupying that land, especially considering that it was a good fertile land, and then was abandoned by the residents of the land. Israel went into the Assyrian captivity, Judah goes into the Babylonish captivity, and that leaves this land laying fallow, ready to be farmed. It's good land. So all these Gentiles came in and over the course of 70 years had settled there, raising families there, doing their business there. And then all of a sudden, here come all these Jews back saying, "This is our land and we're going to rebuild Jerusalem and we're going to rebuild the temple of God. We're bringing back our religion. We don't want any of your foreign gods or your foreign religions." And the people who were there occupying the land didn't take kindly to that. They instead fought them, and that is why the work initially stopped, because the enemies that were still in there in Israel tried to starve them out and tried to fight against them and wipe them out. And so naturally the people concluded, well, then it must not be the time. We're getting beat up here. I guess God doesn't really want us to do that. Haggai says, "The sovereign God, the Lord of hosts, knows your thinking. This people says the time has not come, even the time for the house of Yahweh to be rebuilt." Then the word of Yahweh came by Haggai the prophet, saying, "Is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses while this house, my house, lies desolate? Now, therefore, thus says Yahweh of armies, consider your ways. Now God is going to describe one of the most sovereign aspects of his dealings with people. Listen to his description of how they are living, and then he's going to tell them why they are living that way. And he starts by saying, consider, think about your ways, think about your lives, and see if I'm not telling you the truth. You have sown much. You've planted plenty of seed. But when you harvest little. You eat, but there's not enough to be satisfied. You drink, but there's not enough to even become drunk. You put on clothing, but no one is warm enough. And he who earns wages to put into a purse with holes in it. In other words, I'm making sure you run out of money. I'm making sure that no matter what you do, when you plant your seed, if you have your clothes, if you're gathering grapes, if you're making something to drink, I'm making sure that it's never enough. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, consider your ways. Okay, this is the same God who in Isaiah said, I'm the one who brings about blessings, and I'm the one who brings about trouble. There is no other God but me. I, the Lord, do all these things. Okay, so here's a people group who is going through an amount of difficulty, an amount of trouble, and God takes credit for it and says, why do you think that's happening? I mean, after all, I'm the God who predicted 70 years in Babylon, and then you were going to come back and rebuild. Now you are back, and you are rebuilding, and it's not going well for you. Why do you think that is? And of course, they had concluded, well, it's just not time. But God said, you all have nice houses, and yet you are abandoning the work of rebuilding my house. And since you've abandoned me, look how badly your life is going. And thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountains, bring wood, and rebuild the temple, that I may be pleased with it and be glorified, says Yahweh. Because you look for much, but behold, it comes to little. And when you bring it home, I blow it away. Why? Declares the Lord of hosts. Because of my house, which lies desolate, while each of you run to his own house. So in other words, they've abandoned the work, but they still go back to their own homes. And God says, well, if that's the way that you're going to abandon me, I'll make sure that your lives are never successful. And you're never going to have enough. And you're always going to be hungry. And you're going to be cold. And when you come to the prophet and say, why is it that collectively we're having this much trouble? It's because you abandoned the rebuilding of the house. Remember I said, Haggai just comes out swinging. He says, you're to blame for your current state. And God himself says that you're to blame. You look for much, but behold, it comes to little. When you bring it home, I blow it away. Why, declares the Lord of hosts, because of my house which lies desolate, while each of you runs to his own house. Therefore, because of you, the sky has withheld its dew, and the earth has withheld its produce. I called for a drought on the land, on the mountains, on the grain, on the new wine, on the oil, on what the ground produces, on men, on cattle, and on all the labor of your hands. God just said that he does all that. Okay, so that's a really sovereign God. That's a God that we talk about a lot here. That is a God who can do whatever he wants with what is his. And as we established this last Sunday, what is his would be everything, and he is the king of a domain where all of his subjects are everybody, and he can do whatever he wants with those that are his. And here, because they have abandoned the work that he prophesied they were going to come back and be successful at doing, he then said, I brought a drought on everything. The reason that you're going through this trouble is because you abandoned the work of my house. So then Zerubbabel, the governor, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Lord their God, and they obeyed the words of Haggai the prophet, as the Lord their God had sent him, and the people showed reverence for Yahweh. And then Haggai, the messenger of the Lord, spoke by the commission of the Lord to the people, saying, I am with you. Once you return to the work, once you do the thing I already prophesied you were going to be successful at doing, once you demonstrated your faith in me that I actually am going to accomplish the very thing that I have prophesied about you, once you return to me and do that work, be assured I'm with you. You're going to accomplish this. And sure enough, as we read in Ezra, they did. And they did, according to Ezra, because of the preaching of Haggai and Zechariah, who called them back to that work. So the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and they worked on the house of the Lord of hosts, their God, and on the 24th day of the sixth month in the second year of Darius the king, that work began. That was all technically introduction. You can now go to Zechariah 1:1. We now have the context for the first six verses, which is probably as far as we will get tonight. In the eighth month, remember we just saw the sixth month, they returned to the work. In the eighth month of the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to Zechariah the prophet, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, saying, the Lord was very angry with your fathers. Therefore, say to them, thus says Yahweh of armies, same God, the Lord of hosts, say to them, return to me, declares the Lord of hosts, so that I may return to you. Now, that does not mean that God is creating a situation where it is their willfulness in returning to him that is going to result in him doing the things that he promised he was going to do. He already gave you the clue by saying, I was angry with your fathers. He was angry with that generation that he brought out of Egypt. And so everybody 20 years and older died in the wilderness during those 40 years. It was the second generation that came out of Egypt. Everybody under 20 years old that actually went into Jerusalem and got to experience that land of milk and honey and the blessings that came to King David and King Solomon. But then during that time, they also started chasing their other gods, their foreign gods, the gods of the surrounding Gentile nations. And in the law of God that they had received during those 40 years at Mount Sinai, God was very clear in saying, if you chase after foreign gods, if you go after other gods other than me, I will stop protecting you. I will let your enemies get you. I won't drive the wild animals out of your land. And you will suffer famine, and you will suffer from thirst. All of the bad things that can happen. I will withhold the rain. All of that, God said, I will do to you if you chase after foreign gods. That's exactly what they did, and that is the reason, according to Jeremiah, that they went into the Babylonian captivity. So when God says, return to me, he's saying, recognize that I am your God. I'm the only God. Return to the appropriate worship of me. Build my house. Reverence me. Recognize that I am the God of Israel. And just like he said in the Ten Commandments, you won't have any other God before me. and you won't build your graven images and your idols and bow down to them. Instead, return and recognize that I am the one and only God. I am the God of Israel. And if you'll just do that, I will keep the word that I promised you in the law, which is that I also will then bless you. I will return to you. So those are the standards of the law. Those are the parameters of the law. Follow me faithfully. I will bless you. I'll give you this land of milk and honey. I'll protect you from your enemies. I'll do all that on your behalf. Chase foreign gods. Be an erring wife to me. And then I won't do all that good stuff to you, and I will bring calamity on you. So they chase their other gods. That's what Jeremiah is all about. And as a consequence, he brought them into Babylon for 70 years. He brings them back. And the first thing he tells them through Zechariah is, now that you're back here in your land, return to me. The implication being, with your full heart, recognizing who I am, worshiping me appropriately, and then I'll do all the stuff I said I'd do for you. You return to me and I return to you, says the God of armies. Do not be like your fathers, to whom the former prophets, that would be Isaiah, that would be Jeremiah, to whom the former prophets proclaimed, saying, thus says Yahweh of hosts, return now from your evil ways and from your evil deeds. But they did not listen, and they did not give heed to me, declares the Lord. So he started by saying, don't be like your fathers. I sent prophets to your fathers. They wouldn't listen to the prophets. Now I'm sending prophets to you. Don't be like your fathers. Listen to the word of God. Respond to the word of God. Because God already has a history, he has already demonstrated that if they don't do it his way, he will punish them. And that was the agreement, that was the covenant that he made with them at the very beginning at Mount Sinai. Your fathers, look at this, verse 5, your fathers, where are they? The answer is, they're dead. And the prophets, do they live forever? No, and most of them died, according to Jesus, at the hands of the Jews themselves. So where are your fathers and the prophets? Do they live forever? But did not my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants, the prophets, overtake your fathers? In other words, what he's saying is, you may recall in the Jeremiah teaching, Jeremiah would go to the people. He would tell them the word of God. They would not only reject it, but then they would heap prophets to themselves who would tell them the opposite of what Jeremiah said and would prophesy good things and would say, oh, no, God would never do that. Oh, no, God would never harm you. No, no, God's a loving God. No, he wouldn't do anything like that to you. Meanwhile, Jeremiah was right. And as a consequence, the 70 years in Babylon actually did happen. And God says right here, I gave my words and my statutes to my servants, the prophets. And then all your fathers and the prophets all died, proving that my word was accurate. My word is right. My word perseveres. My word continues. And my word proves itself. And now you can look back on that history. It's just a generation away from you. You can look back on that and see that this is how I am. This is what I'm like. This is what I do. And this is what I will do to you. Don't be like them. Get busy. Build my house. Pretty inspiring. If you're among the Jews in Jerusalem and you've got this 1-2 punch coming from Haggai and Zechariah, you're really getting a feel for, oh, that's right. This is the God who is known for taking people out of the land and putting them in captivity and killing their kings. And, oh, yeah, we're cold and we're hungry. And that God said it's our fault. We really should go back and rebuild his house, considering who he is and considering that he has promised us if we return to him, he'll return to us. And we will have food. We will have wine. We will have clothes. So there's every inspiration here to get back to work. And according to Ezra, it worked. They did get back and finish the work. But did not my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants the prophets, overtake your fathers? And then they repented and said, as the Lord of hosts purposed to do to us in accordance with our ways and our deeds, so he has dealt with us. In other words, they came to the realization that sovereign God did exactly what he said he was going to do. The God of the Bible has already told you what he's going to do, what he's like, what he expects from you, that he is sovereign, that he is in control, and that we are all subject to him. And he expects worship, and he expects reverence, and he expects that you're going to be faithful to him and not chase after any other gods. And he has this long, rich history, like what we're reading tonight, demonstrating that he's perfectly willing to defend his own righteousness, his own uniqueness, his own singularity. He's willing to defend all that if his people don't give him the worship that is due him. So the same way that he is saying to that first generation that has gone back to Jerusalem out of the Babylonian captivity, he's saying, you can look back at God's history and see what he's like, and you don't want to mess with that God. And I think that's a lesson we can all take away from these first introductory comments tonight. That God is like God is. Not only does he have a history of being like that, but it's recorded for us. It's written down by the prophets of Israel that this is what God is like. And since God doesn't change, then what we have learned tonight about the character of God and the nature of God continues to be the character and the nature of God. Therefore, if that God has saved you, if that God has separated you to himself, he has expectations from you. And he has every right as the sovereign judge of the universe to lay his expectations on you and then expect you to respond. And the one, as we've been seeing in men's group, the one big requirement that God has right now is that you trust Christ. That is the finished work that will get you to your heavenly destiny. And failure to trust Christ throughout the New Testament results in God's wrath, God's judgment, exactly like we saw with the forefathers in Israel, exactly like we saw with the people who stopped the work, because God is consistent and the Bible only tells one story about a God who is faithful and gracious and kind, but he's also a judge and he also has expectations of his people that they will recognize him, his uniqueness, his onlyness, and will worship him accordingly and appropriately. Got it?
That's him.
Okay, so that's Zechariah. You engaged so far?
Yes.
All right, so then despite hail, maybe we'll come back next week and do it again. Because next week we leap headlong into the visions of Zechariah. And for the next 8 chapters, we're going to be looking at these tremendous visions. So any questions, comments, feedback, interpretive dance, anything? Oh, I got that from Laurel. All right, good. I thought she was saying, I'll do the interpretive dance. And I was, and we were all anxious. I think several of us were willing to pay to see that.
So.
All right, then good.